Do you have investment properties you're considering selling and would like to learn how to defer the tax consequences? Then you need to call Equity Advantage and learn about a 1031 exchange. A 1031 exchange is a powerful investment tool. It enables you to keep a property's equity intact when it's used to acquire like-kind replacement property of equal or greater value and equity, even if you recently acquired the property. For over 30 years, Equity Advantage has been providing investors solutions for deferring taxes and maximizing the value of investments through a 1031 exchange. At Equity Advantage, we don't sell investments, but rather provide the tax deferment tools and expertise to facilitate their sale and transfer. Learn more by going to 1031exchange.com or Google YouTube Equity Advantage for in-depth videos. Listen, you've worked hard for the money in your investments. Equity Advantage works hard to keep it yours.
Learn more about 1031 exchanges and Equity Advantage at 1031exchange.com. That's 1031exchange.com.
The best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I think you've heard me say it before, that if I drank Pendleton whiskey and smoked weed that I bought at LaModa, I don't smoke weed, by the way, but if I did both of those things, I couldn't make up stuff half as crazy as the legislatures of Oregon and Washington and sometimes even Idaho come up with on their own. For example, there is House Bill 2002. Now, we've told you all about it. If you read the mainstream media, they couch this this bill, this prospective law, in the kind of terms that camouflage what it does. Why, it provides gender-affirming care and reproductive health services for all ages. And you say, what does that mean? You say, well, it means that when a kid says he was born a boy but wants to be a girl, we'll chemically castrate him. Well, that doesn't sound as good, does it? And we'll also make sure that if a 10-year-old girl is pregnant, she can get an abortion without mom and dad even knowing about it. What? It says that? I said, yeah. And then the latest piece of it that we've got to tell you about, currently, believe it or not, if you are a young lady who's pregnant, whether you're a child or an adult, and you bear your child, and the child is delivered and either delivers dead or is delivered still alive and you allow it to die, and then you bury the body in the backyard, that's currently a misdemeanor crime. This would make sure that it is no longer a misdemeanor crime. That's how crazy House Bill 2002 is. So I thought I'd talk about it with Pastor Richard Peel, who is from Ben's Victory Baptist Church. Pastor Peel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Appreciate you having me on.
So you're concerned about House Bill 2002, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely, with I would hope would be millions of other Oregonians.
So what's your organization going to do about it? Because I'd like to see somebody fight this. So far, the Republicans are fighting by staying walked out and denying quorum to the crazy Democrats who want to pass it. But I'm afraid that they're going to be facing, if they don't come back to the legislature, the voter-approved measure says they may be denied the right to ever run for re-election to their seats. I don't think that's constitutional, but that is the law right now, and they may just come back anyway and allow the Democrats to pass it. So how are you going to block it?
Well, I don't know that we have a direct game plan as yet as to blocking it, but today we did hold a press conference down on the state capitol mall. We had about 25 or 30 pastors from across Oregon representing, and I don't know, a couple hundred people turned out live. A few media outlets were there, and we were trying to unmask the bill, just as you mentioned, for the benefit of our fellow Oregonians so they can see what it really would do. We view it as a direct infringement and really an attack on the sanctity of the family unit, and replacing the state really as a protecting agent over our children rather than mom and dad.
Well, I got to tell you, Pastor Peel, I don't have a problem with the state protecting children. If what you mean is if a child is being abused or we even suspect it, the state may have to come in and take a child away if there's evidence a child's being abused. If the child's been the subject of a criminal activity by mom or dad, the state should intervene. But if you mean, and because the Democrats say it this way, if you mean we want to protect this 10-year-old girl by not telling mom and dad she's pregnant, not telling mom and dad we're going to obtain an abortion for her, or not telling mom and dad your son or daughter claims to be of the opposite gender and we're going to make medical, chemical, and perhaps even surgical changes to your child and you don't have any right to know about it, I don't put that in the category of protecting children. I imagine you don't either.
That is correct. We agree at the first statement that proper protection against abuse is necessary and essential function of state. But this certainly would not be protection of anybody but state operators in really defiling our children if they're given that opportunity. You may add also, Lars, furthermore, in that bill, not only do parents not have a right to know, but if parents attempt to interfere or raise a protest or, as the bill says, quote unquote, cause the phone to ring in a clinic, they can be charged with a misdemeanor crime and punished in jail for 364 days.
Yeah, see, I just think there's so many things about this. As a non-lawyer, I think it's unconstitutional to say that a citizen can't call the clinic, and I don't mean threaten the clinic, but call the clinic and say what you're doing to children is wrong. That is your First Amendment right to do that. Now, if you harass people, if you threaten them, if you make them fear for your safety, I'd agree that's a crime. But in this case, they're going to basically open the doors up so that any parent can end up being charged with a crime for trying to actually protect their children, which the state is not. I don't think the state is protecting a child if they endorse the mistaken belief that the child is a boy trapped in a girl's body or vice versa, and then start saying, well, we're going to give you chemicals and surgery and everything else to make that happen, and your parents don't have a right to know, and we're not going to tell them. I don't think that's protecting the child, and I would expect any parent to object to that. And yet we're making parents criminals and driving a wedge between the parents and their kids.
I totally agree with you. In our state, a child can't get a tattoo without parental consent, and yet we're saying that we're going to allow children to reassign their sex without parental consent or knowledge.
So how is it that so many faith-based organizations, churches, most of them, are not standing up and objecting to this? Has it struck you that your faith-based group is in the minority on this, and many of the faith-based groups are actually standing up and endorsing this garbage?
There is a definite divide among Christian sectarian movements today, not just in our state, but across the country. There's no doubt of that. And when it comes to the other ones who would actually endorse, support, get behind this type of legislation, I don't have a lot of conversations with that camp, so I can't really speak to as to their biblical reasoning to support this. But for us, you know, our group, we just believe that God made man in his own image and likeness. He made them male and female, made he them, and that reality needs to be safeguarded and protected for the families to sort through all those other matters and not the state.
I would agree with you. I don't know. Did you happen to bring up that aspect? And it's one I will admit, I don't know every piece of legislation in Oregon, Washington, Idaho by heart. But, you know, the part about abortion, the part about abortion for 10-year-olds, the part about transgender children and not telling parents what's going on and basically subverting the role of the parents and saying, we're going to let the kid do it and you don't have any right to know. But I hadn't even realized until this week that it also took the misdemeanor crime of concealing a baby's body, a born baby's body, and concealing that body, which is now a misdemeanor. It's not a serious crime. And I don't imagine anybody goes to jail and say, no, it shouldn't be a crime to take a dead baby's body and bury it in your backyard or dump it in a dumpster.
Well, and the problem with that is it removes all the ability to investigate the cause of death.
Yeah, it does.
So, and interstate, you know, my concern is, you know, this bill would essentially make Oregon a sanctuary state for kids coming from other states to receive medical, quote-unquote, medical procedures here that would result in the death of a child, abortion, and then the state that they return to maybe has laws against that, but they now have no way to investigate what happened while that child was in Oregon.
That's a very good point. Pastor Richard Peel, he's with a group from Oregon's Victory Baptist Church that's standing up against House Bill 2002, and the Democrats are hot to pass the law. If you're a naysayer, I'll be glad to get your call at 866-HEY-LARS. Your phone calls and emails on the issues of the day coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. As you know, the number, 866-HEY-LARS. You can also email talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our daily Twitter poll. You can find that two places, at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. On our website, we don't have any of the deficits of Twitter, although Twitter is getting better these days. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the program a great conservative, the man who headed up the Moral Majority for 5 years, syndicated columnist, television, radio, and now a dozen books to match the number of grandchildren he has, Mr. Cal Thomas. Mr. Thomas, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you, Lars. Call me Cal. Mr. Thomas is my father.
I will do that. Cal, I got to ask you this. 12 books, and the latest one, just so people know, A Watchman in the Night, what I've seen over 50 years of reporting on America. It's a brilliant title because we need some people to keep an eye on things. What do you want to tell people about in this book?
Well, it is not a column collection, but it is a roadmap or a diary, as the subtitle says, of what I've seen over nearly 40 years as a syndicated columnist and longer than that as a reporter before then. One of the things I think people ought to understand is that human nature never changes. And whether you have Republicans or Democrats in power, they seem to repeat the same old things. You look at the debt limit business right now, and you hear Biden and the Democrats saying, well, if we don't raise the debt limit, then veterans' benefits are going to be cut. Your Social Security check won't arrive. You know, the sky will fall. We've been hearing this sort of stuff for 40 years. People need to pay attention that they're being bamboozled and razzle-dazzled by the politicians. What I've done in this book is to go back, and I reread most of my 4,000 columns that I've written over the years, and just picked out little excerpts and commented on what was going on at the time and my take on each of those incidents. I think people who are of a certain age and remember living through those years will find it a great reminder. And those who are younger who read the book will find it, I think, some useful history for going forward.
Cal, tell me this. Have you seen, because I know that there are people with a perspective where they say, oh, this is brand new. We've never done this before. But you tell me, have we ever seen the kind of collision of culture and politics and the really vigorous, not just debate, but antagonism between the sides? Now, I've got my own position on a lot of these culture issues like transgender, like abortion on demand through a pill you can get over the counter, things like that. Have we ever seen it get this bad? Because I think it is bad for America.
Well, probably not culturally, but certainly we've been divided many times in the past. We our forebears were divided during the Revolution, 1776. We had the Civil War, of course. We had the great divisions over Vietnam, the civil rights movement, the riots in the streets, the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Bobby Kennedy. So there have always been divisions, but usually the cultural center has held. Beginning in the 60s with the If It Feels Good, Do It generation and the hippies, that began to unravel. And the problem is when you do not have a shared moral sense or value system, then as Cole Porter wrote in a song, anything goes. And that's what we have today. Anything goes. And if you stand up against anything, you just mentioned a few, there are many others, then you're immediately denounced as a bigot, one of many kind of phobes, intolerant, racist, and the usual labels of the left. And that has caused a lot of people to cower and not stand up or traditional values because they don't want to be denounced.
Well, you and I have in common that we're both Christians. You're an evangelical Christian. I actually grew up in the Presbyterian Church. You're in the Presbyterian Church. But an awful lot of people who call my show or email say, Lars, the reason we're so screwed up in this country right now is that we've left God behind. And I think they're right to some extent, although it doesn't really suggest a path to an answer because I had a discussion last night with a family member, and she's a little bit more liberal than me. And she said, well, you know, we're not just a Christian nation. I said, no, but we're a nation founded by Christians who were smart enough to write a document in the Constitution to say, we will be a nation that is not a theocracy. Every religion is welcome, but you need belong to none of them. And in fact, we'll even make it a rule in the Constitution. You can't say, well, you have to be a person of faith to hold public office. An atheist could sit on the Supreme Court. I don't think it's likely, but they could. And they could be president of the United States. They could be a senator. How have we left that behind, and how do we get back to some of those rock-solid values where we say there are truths that we shouldn't say, oh, no, this, you know, the Constitution's a piece of silly putty, and you can mold it into anything you want it to be today?
Well, many decades ago, there was a supplemental book in our public schools called the McGuffey Readers. And among other things, it taught patriotism, respect for your parents, love of your fellow man, honesty, integrity, right versus wrong. Now we don't have any of that. And one of the few things I learned in physics before I flunked table of contents was that nature abhors a vacuum. Now, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the old Chase and Sanborn coffee. They vacuum packed it in these cans, and that was a big selling point. You'd push down on the top, and it would click, and it would indicate that there's a vacuum inside. And then when you opened it, there was a little key that came with it. You twisted the key on the slot on the side of the coffee can. You would hear the air rush in. Nature abhors a vacuum. Something has to fill it. And if it's not God, and if it's not the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount and a moral code that teaches right from wrong, good from evil, then you're going to have a vacuum that the secular progressives are more than willing to invade. And that's what we have today. We, who are Christians and conservatives and care about the country, need to get our kids out of these indoctrination centers known as public schools and universities that teach critical race theory, drag queen story time in kindergarten, a hatred of America, revisionist history. Why would you send, we don't send our troops into foreign countries like Russia and China and Iran to be trained. We train them here. So why would we send our children into these indoctrination centers that teach the opposite of what we believe and expect that they'll come out believing the same things? It's crazy. So it begins with education.
I couldn't agree with you more. The book is called A Watchman in the Night. It is his 12th book by Cal Thomas, you know, the man you know so well as a syndicated columnist, as a staunch conservative in America. Are you then invigorated or do you see hope in the fact that a number of states have finally, at long last, a lot of us have been begging for it for a while, they've embraced the idea of school choice, saying if you don't like the government-operated indoctrination centers called the so-called public schools, we'll give you a chunk of money, as Arizona's doing and some other states are doing, and you can take it and obtain the education for your child elsewhere. Are we seeing a watershed moment in education that will lead us to real school choice and bring the public schools back in line through competition, or is this just a blip?
Yes, no, I think there are 37 states now that have some form of school choice. It's amazing to me that my friends on the left, who are very pro-choice when it comes to abortion, are anti-choice when it comes to freedom of education. And if you're going to have kids, you have a responsibility not only for their physical protection and upbringing, but for their moral upbringing as well.
I'm talking to Cal Thomas. He's the author most recently of A Watchman in the Night, What I've Seen Over 50 Years of Reporting on America. Cal Thomas and I will be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails a bit later. I'm talking to Cal Thomas. He's a great conservative, and you know him so well from syndicated columns, from television, from radio, and from now a dozen books, the most recent of which is A Watchman in the Night, What I've Seen Over 50 Years of Reporting on America. Before we finish up the last segment, Cal, you mentioned George Wallace standing in the schoolhouse door. Now, I'm only 64, so I only know it from history. But I got to thinking, can you imagine? Well, I have to read about all these things. I'll say, do you remember when? And then I'll mention something from 80 years ago when I wasn't around. But can you imagine what black families might have said had they had the school choices now being offered, as you said, in 37 states? They said, fine, Governor Wallace, stand the schoolhouse door all you want. We'll go out and start our own schools. And it reminded me of a black school principal. I think he was fairly conservative, and he was on the show 20 years ago, and he was very outspoken. And he said, Lars, he said, in a lot of ways, we got a better education then than we offer now. And I said, why is that? He says, because smart black young people who were teachers weren't allowed to teach in the public schools. So he says, therefore, the black only schools got great teachers, you know, and because they were all forced to work in those schools, you know, they had no other choice. And I said that was an interesting perspective from a guy who'd grown up in that kind of school. Not that I'd wish we'd go back to that, but black families then, if they'd had school choice, might well have said, fine, you run your schools any way you want, Governor Wallace. We're going to go out and start our own, and we'll probably get better test scores than your kids do.
Yeah, well, poll after poll has shown that African-American parents want the choice of where to send their children. I mean, every parent loves their child. But this goes back to political control. If you look at this Weingarten woman who's the head of the American Federation of Teachers, I mean, you know, she advocated for the shutdown of schools during COVID, and she thought that was going to be a good thing. But it's come back to haunt her because a lot of parents found out what was being taught in their schools at that time. They learned the value of homeschooling their child, and they decided after the schools opened again not to send their kids back. I think it is a new form of racism to deny particularly African-American families in poor communities the right to have a choice to educate their children in the best possible way. And I think Republicans and conservatives ought to turn this around on the left and accuse them of racism for a change. They're always accusing us of that and other labels. Let's make them defend what they're doing. They always say, well, what we need is more money for these schools. Well, we already spend record amounts of money per child in the public school system in America, and yet we have fourth and fifth graders who can't read to level. We're way behind China in math and science. So if money and education achievement were linked, we ought to have national merit scholarships coming out of our ears.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm talking to Cal Thomas, author of A Watchman in the Night, most recently, What I've Seen Over 50 Years of Reporting in America. And it's funny that you mentioned choice, because people will call me and say, well, we can't do this. We'll ruin the public schools. I said, ruin them by punishing them for doing a bad job. And I'll ask these people, I said, do you have any family members on Medicare? And they'll say, yeah. I said, do you have to take them to a government hospital to spend that Medicare? And they said, well, no. I said, do you know anybody on food stamps? Do you have to go to a government grocery store, which basically don't exist outside of PXs and BXs? There are no government grocery stores. I said, do you have to spend your food stamps at a government grocery store? Why should you have to spend every education dollar at a government school? Why shouldn't you be able to take it anywhere you want, like a Pell Grant?
Yes. Well, you've answered your own question. The proof is in the pudding, to invoke an old saying. And I just cited these statistics about how we're so far behind China especially, and in reading skills. I mean, this is a disgrace for the supposed most powerful nation on earth to have kids who are not on reading level by fifth or sixth grade and who can't do basic math. We've got all this stuff coming into the schools now about transgenderism and bathrooms and locker rooms of boys who thinks they're girls and all of this other stuff. This is crazy. This is not education. This is indoctrination. It's propaganda. And it's time for us. You know, you just said some of the critics say, well, if we do this, we have school choice, we'll ruin the public schools. They're already ruined. That's the problem. If the school is on fire, get the kids out. Go for the fire extinguisher. Don't stay there and hope the fire will go out on its own.
Let me ask you, I'm talking to Cal Thomas, author of Watchmen in the Night. Cal, right now, as you and I are talking, we have seen in the last 2 years 9 million people illegally cross into America, I believe at the invitation of Joe Biden and with the aiding and abetting of his Secretary of Homeland Security. The founders of this country anticipated a lot in the Constitution. I thought they were brilliant. They seemed to anticipate almost anything. They didn't anticipate when a president would simply say, we're going to erase a border and we're going to have millions and millions of people invade our country outside the law and with consequences that will last for decades. What do we do about this?
Well, first of all, any president, any senator, any member of Congress, any high official swears to uphold the laws of the United States and protect the Constitution. That is not what's going on right now. We have immigration laws on the books that are being violated. One of the contributing factors to the decline of great nations in the past, as I wrote in a previous book, America's Expiration Date, is the uncontrolled immigration without assimilation. There's also a massive national debt, over $31 trillion. That's another contributing factor. And then the third one is the loss of a shared set of moral values. That certainly is beyond argument at the moment. So this is a disgrace. I mean, I don't think you have to be a conspiracy theorist to say that the secular progressives want this flood of people because they think they'll be able to turn red states blue, win elections for decades to come. Republicans will never win the White House again. Turn them into addicts to government programs and then tell them if you don't vote for us and we'll make sure you're able to vote right away, then those evil Republicans are going to take your programs away from you. It is a form of political sedition and ought to be an embarrassment.
I'm talking to Cal Thomas. Cal, tell me this. We're at almost $32 trillion in national debt right now. The president has said, the president who has a senator and VP would talk about negotiating over the debt ceiling limit. That's what Republicans have been asking for 3 months. But ultimately, the problem is running us into so much debt that it begins to eclipse whole chunks of the federal budget just to pay the interest on it. Various people have suggested various mechanisms for bringing federal spending within limits. That is, don't spend more than you take in, like every family listening to this show has to do. Is there any mechanism that can bring federal spending under control, or is there not a magic solution, a penny plan, as some have proposed?
Well, a couple of things. We mentioned Ronald Reagan earlier. One of his more famous lines was, the only proof of eternal life in Washington is a government program. It's easier to kill a vampire than a government program. But the analogy is a good one, because each one sucks the lifeblood out of its host. I think we have to get back to the notion of individual liberty. We the people, not you the government. There are far too many people who are over-reliant on government and not self-reliant. During the last Medicare open season, I saw a lot of ads on television that contained four words, every one of them: free, deserve, entitled, and what was the fourth one? It just went out of my mind. But anyway, the notion is that somehow you are entitled to other people's money. We now subsidize the things we claim we don't want more of and penalize the things we do say we want more of. You look at Bernie Sanders the other day, said there ought to be 100% tax on anybody who makes over $1 billion. You hear the president talking about fair share in taxes. The government takes in more revenue than any time in history. It's not revenue that's the problem.
I'm talking to Cal Thomas, who's author most recently of his 12th book, A Watchman in the Night, What I've Seen Over 50 Years Reporting on America. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a genuine pleasure to have with us a great American conservative, Cal Thomas. I want to ask you about a couple of thorny problems. Let's start with the budget first. And Cal, I'll tell you, the other day, a listener called in and said, Lars, we got to cut federal spending. I said, great, I'm going to make you king of America for the next 90 seconds. What do you want to cut? And he goes, well, what do you mean? I said, well, two-thirds of the budget is so-called entitlement, something that people who receive Social Security don't like the word, but it is an entitlement. You worked for it, you earned it, you're entitled to it, at least in law, but it is facing a brick wall. Do you want to cut that? And he said, no. I said, how about Medicare? He said, no. I said, how about the Pentagon? He said, no. I said, right there, we've talked about more than two-thirds of the entire budget. There ain't much left to cut. How do we go about trimming that down?
Well, like I said in the last segment, I think we need an outside auditor. Every cabinet level and every law has a piece of enabling legislation, or in the case of cabinets, a charter. The auditors come in and they take a look at it and they say, is it fulfilling its purpose? Could it be done better by the private sector or for less money? And if it is outmoded, then we get rid of it. For years, we had a helium reserve fund, thinking that the dirigible was going to be useful in war. There was a federal tea tasting commission. Apparently, the government didn't think that your taste buds were good enough to decide what kind of tea you liked, and so they were going to tell you. I mean, granted, these are fringe things, but they all add up. Now, everybody knows that Social Security and Medicare need to be reformed. That's just beyond debate. Social Security is going to run out of tax money in 10 years. There's not a little fund in the Treasury Department that has your money in it. That's one of the big lies. The current workers are supporting the retirees, who hope when they retire that they'll be supported by those who have retired before them. But we can't continue like this. So there are three choices. You're either going to have to raise taxes, or you're going to have to reduce benefits, or you're going to have to raise the age of retirement. There's no other choice but those three unless we reform it. Not everybody needs Social Security. I don't need it. I don't know if you do or not. Why does everybody get it? It's all about votes.
But I got to ask you, Cal, you headed the moral majority. Tell me about the moral.
That was Jerry Falwell. I never headed the moral majority.
But you were with You were with the
Mormons. That was my one non-journalistic thing. Yes.
Okay,
wrote a
fair
book
enough
about it.
But let me ask you about that, because do we create a moral hazard when we say, okay, those of you who've provided for yourself, and I think I've provided well for my wife and myself, and you say, you did the right, you put money aside, you paid off a house, you did all those right things. For that, you get punished. You don't get a benefit. Because unless we want to treat it like a welfare program, and I don't think it should be a welfare program, you say those who went out and took every paycheck every week and spent every dime they had, never put away a penny for the future or for their own retirement, you get the reward of the biggest benefit. While it solves the numerical problem with Social Security, you means test it, the problem I see is you're punishing people for good behavior and rewarding them for bad behavior. And when the government does that, you get more bad behavior, don't you?
Right. Exactly. That's human nature. You saw what Biden said the other day. He wanted to subsidize mortgages for people with bad credit and pay for that by raising the cost of people with good credit. Now, what kind of a crazy idea is that? I mean, this is the way the left thinks in this country. Look, I think there ought to be a system where people can opt out of Social Security earlier in their working years and put the money into mutual funds or whatever they want to personally invest. And then that will wind up with a bigger nest egg than they could ever hope for by just relying on Social Security. And that's one way to reform the program. Again, you know, they're having this big debate in France right now. Macron wants to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, and people are rioting in the streets. Well, you can't sustain something unless you have enough workers to earn paychecks to pay into the system. I mean, we've killed over 60 million babies through abortion in this country. Imagine if how many of those had been born, grew up, got jobs, paid taxes, we wouldn't have some of the problems we have today.
You know, you hit one of the thorniest issues that we all deal with. The number of abortions has been trending downward. But at the same time that it's trending downwards, the liberals, they say, then let's make abortion easier. Let's make it as easy as walking into a pharmacy, say, I've got a 4-month or 6-month or 8-month baby inside, or weak baby inside of me. I'd like a pill to get rid of it. And we want to make that as easy as pie. What is going on with a crowd of people who, while the number of abortions have been trending down, thank God, that they say, well, then we've got to make it easier and easier?
Well, I believe, Lars, there's a connection between the way we have devalued life in the womb and the way we have devalued life in the streets. You see in Chicago, for example, 10, 15, 20 shootings and killings virtually every weekend and almost every night now in our major cities around the country. And if we disrespect, if we devalue human life in one category, it is very easy and a short step to devalue it in others. There are now people arguing for euthanasia. Vermont, for example, has just approved a measure that will allow people to come from out of state to commit suicide in Vermont. Previously, it was only for Vermonters who wanted to end their lives that they could get doctor-assisted suicide. Now you can come there, you can go to Oregon, I think the state of Washington, and this is what happens.
His latest book, his 12th, is A Watchman in the Night. We'll be back. Are you part of the great resignation, that mass exodus of people who are leaving their jobs to start something new? Then something you need to consider is what to do with your company 401k. Rather than just rolling it over, consider opening a truly self-directed IRA. With a self-directed IRA, a truly self-directed IRA, your retirement portfolio can include real estate, precious metals, cryptocurrency, notes, loans, a new business, and traditional equities like stocks and bonds. You can make any investment the law allows with a truly self-directed retirement account. Listen, you probably have questions, so why not take the time to get the answers? Start with going to IRAAdvantage.com. Then talk to the truly self-directed IRA professionals at IRA Advantage.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. Let us set up a truly self-directed IRA for you. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I will get back to your phone calls and your emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. And as you know, on this show for more than a quarter century, naysayers go to the head of the line. So if you disagree with me, feel free to call. You'll be put first in line to talk. Just be ready to go. If you'd rather email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can always find our daily Twitter poll. The question is always written from the news of the day, so it's fresh. And we're about to talk about something fresh, but find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. If you listen regularly, you understand I'm a person who's enthralled with technology. I couldn't write code to save my life, but I like the results of technology. I also understand that a lot of technology is both good and bad, that the same cell phone that is incredibly convenient and probably literally saves lives at times can also be used to defraud you of your life savings, can be used to intrude into your home and put your kids and others at risk. And AI, artificial intelligence, seems to be that idea on steroids, that artificial intelligence both has the promise to do great things for human beings and the promise to do great damage. And for a lot of us, you know, the realization has been AI is there now, and we're seeing it now because everybody is talking about ChatGPT and things like that. But there are folks like John Dwyer, who's president of the Global Alzheimer's Platform Foundation, who would point out to you, no, AI has already been in the works and already literally threatening people's lives right now, especially the people who are advocated for by the Global Alzheimer's Platform Foundation. Mr. Dwyer, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Lars. It's great to be back.
Before we get too deep into this, I'd be remiss if I didn't offer you an opportunity to describe to my audience what the Global Alzheimer's Platform Foundation does for people who may get Alzheimer's or are already suffering or who have an Alzheimer's person in their family and friends. Would you mind doing that?
Be thrilled to do that. The Global Alzheimer's Platform is a not-for-profit organization dedicated to trying to speed up and improve clinical trials to bring therapies and cures for Alzheimer's and other central nervous system diseases faster. And we have been working on this now for 7 years. We're very active in all the clinical trial work that we've been reading about with all the new therapies that have started to emerge. And we are pleased today to say that I think patients with Alzheimer's are going to have a really good therapy available to them as early as July of this year.
Would it be fair to say, before we start bashing on the bad aspects of AI, that AI, artificial intelligence, might actually hold some of the tools that could actually make some of the treatment for Alzheimer's better if it's used that way? Is that fair to say?
Yes, if I could just take a second. You know,
sure.
AI is many things to many people, but it is in its purest form a different way to look at data and find patterns and determine with a high degree of confidence that certain things are happening in the case of healthcare, that certain things are happening that are likely to be related to certain causes. So in our world, in Alzheimer's, we're eagerly awaiting better uses for artificial intelligence so that we could perfect clinical trials and not spend $500 million to $1 billion to find out a drug doesn't work, but instead to model the performance of that drug against historical data and say, is that going to help people progressing in the disease? Will they respond to this drug? And narrow the likelihood that these drug trials will fail. That will bring us therapies sooner to patients. That's the good part of AI. But there's also a part of AI that we have to be very careful with, and that is the use of statistics generally and AI specifically to start modeling who's going to benefit from the healthcare system providing them care. And this is where a concept called QALYs comes in, and it's an acronym for quality life years. And there are people that try to measure whether a therapy is doing enough to justify the resources it requires to be purchased. Price versus benefit. Very big topic, very difficult topic to handle. Everybody would like drugs to be at the lowest possible price possible with the maximum amount of efficiency. The AI problem is that they use these models, and it's against a fictitious definition of good. So essentially, the models are being run in a way to say, we are going to say a drug is good as if it can return patients to exactly the state of perfect health we imagine people could have with a perfect drug.
Right.
Or a surgery or another condition to a perfect drug. And I'll just make one simple example, Lars.
Sure.
And then I'll give you another one for Alzheimer's.
All right.
We all know who Franklin Delano Roosevelt was.
Yep.
And we have Governor Abbott down in Texas. Neither one of those gentlemen can walk or could walk because of disease affecting them or a terrible accident. But that doesn't mean they can't live a full and productive life. But they are having a different kind of life experience than people that can walk. Does that diminish the quality of their life? Let's ask them, and I think we'd all agree they're having very productive lives. In the same case, they're saying, well, Alzheimer's or other diseases, by the way, if we're not returning them to full cognitive health, they're not living a full productive life, and the drug is not very helpful. But the truth is that if we can slow the progression of diseases, substantially reduce the amount of progression, we're giving back a high degree of quality of life to patients. They're able to remember their grandchildren. They're able to take care of themselves, not be a burden to their family, which is something they all want to avoid, and generally be able to continue their life for many years to come in a very high-functioning way if we have drugs that will just slow the progression of the fatal disease known as Alzheimer's. But the people that use AI for generating qualities are saying, no, it's either perfect, and we're going to make it the enemy of the good.
John, I want to continue this conversation in a moment. If you're willing to stick around, I'd really appreciate it.
Sure.
John Dwyer is the president of the Global Alzheimer's Platform Foundation. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I will get back to calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. You can always send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and check out our Instagram feed as well. I've got John Dwyer with me, who's the president of the Global Alzheimer's Platform Foundation. And you might wonder, well, why is a guy who's advocating for people with Alzheimer's and their family and friends, why is he concerned about AI? AI might actually help the scientists come up with better ways of treating Alzheimer's patients. And of course, that's true. But as he's pointed out, this idea of QALY, you know, federal agencies love stuff. I remember 30 or 40 years ago, John, I became familiar with a thing called YPLL, Years of Productive Life Lost, where they were actually quantifying. If you had the death of an 80-year-old, well, on the books, he only probably had another couple of years coming to him. So if his life was lost, it was less serious than if somebody who was 17 years old and healthy lost his or her life, because then you had 70 or 80 years of productive life lost. You've educated me to this idea of QALY, quality adjusted life years. And you say right now, even though the FDA has approved a number of new drugs to treat people with Alzheimer's, the folks who actually hand out the cash to cover the cost of those treatments, Medicare, is saying, no, our AI tells us that it's not going to get us enough improvement to be worth the cost. Therefore, we're not going to allow you to have them. And both of these are government agencies that are effectively working in opposite directions. Would you please describe that relationship?
I absolutely will. But just because I know, Lars, you're a stickler for accuracy.
Okay, please correct me.
Yeah. Just technically, quality adjusted life years is something that Medicare says they do not take into account.
Now,
let me
true?
Be clear.
Is that true?
Well, that's what I want to, you know, they read the newspapers, they read the public publications that groups like ICER put out, and that's exactly what ICER is saying. So I want you to, but I got to just be intellectually honest enough with you and your audience to say, Medicare will say they don't look at that, and yet how do they ignore all the drug rhetoric that these companies, these enterprises put out using quality? So I just wanted your audience to be able to understand it's hard to believe they don't read the paper. But
well,
short of that,
John, officially they're saying they don't use it. But then again, I remember a vice presidential candidate named Sarah Palin who said they're going to use death panels. And of course, nobody in government would call it a death panel, just like nobody in government would call it a ministry of truth. But we know that despite their denials and all their denials to the contrary, that sometimes government bureaucracies use things they just don't want to admit they're using. And I'm wondering if that's the case.
Well, I'm certain there's a lot of things that are going on at Medicare in their deliberations that we wouldn't necessarily agree with, and that would be one of them. How's that?
Okay,
and
that
so
works
let
for
me. Tell you what's, let me tell you what's absolutely clear and not subject to a lot of debate. The FDA has approved literally hundreds of drugs that Medicare has then approved coverage to label. That means FDA says this form of insulin is approved for injection by folks with diabetes, and Medicare turns right around and says, FDA approved it, we're going to pay for insulin at the price the drug company is offering it to us. And hundreds of drugs have been treated that way. Then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Medicare concludes that they're going to change their policy. Not a change in legislation from Congress authorizing it. They just look at two words, reasonable, actually three words, reasonable and necessary, and reinterpret what reasonable and necessary allows. And so now, Lars, you have Medicare approving a class of drugs for Alzheimer's that takes a protein out of our brain that is associated with Alzheimer's disease that improves our quality of life. And they're saying, yeah, it's not, we aren't convinced yet, so we're not going to cover it to label the same way that we have covered literally hundreds of other drugs. Cancer drugs, rheumatoid arthritis drugs, diabetes drugs, the list is really long. And so this dichotomy is unsustainable. You can't have the agency that is the experts at saying what is safe and effective then be overruled by the payer, Medicare, which doesn't even cover everybody. They also have Medicaid beneficiaries who can get this drug right now, although they're trying to not cover them as well. And then you didn't even mention that there's a third agency. The Veterans Administration just came out and said they are going to give vets the drug and they will pay for the drug.
Good for them.
So
I'm glad to hear it.
But
effectively, you have the same federal government with four different agencies, I guess, if you want to count it that way. Medicare, Medicaid. You've got Medicare and Medicaid and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid,
VA.
One agency. And then you've got FDA and then you've got the VA. And they're all going in different directions for no discernible reason other than money?
Well, there you go. Good on you. The what is different about our condition, and Medicare will deny this, but the math is clear that if you look at that FDA-approved drug, by the way, the name of the drug is Leqembi, L-E-Q-E-M-B-I, and Leqembi is going to get a full traditional approval, we hope, on July the 6th. Medicare is looking at how many people can actually get on the drug, Lars. There could be 1 million people that could benefit from this drug. And right. Medicare has never seen that big a group of people at $26,000 infusion per year come to them looking for drugs. Now, it's not going to be 1 million overnight, and it'll be phased in, but just do the math. Let's just embrace the problem. They're looking at a potentially around a 20-some billion-dollar spend on a drug if everybody that could get the drug needed the drug, and that's a lot of money. We shouldn't quibble about that. That's a lot of money. The problem is Congress hasn't given them the authority to worry about cost. Well, I think you make a really good point, and I think there are two things that we all have to understand. The first is, until this decision by Medicare, these questions of cost, by the way, Medicare beneficiaries have to pay 20% of this price. So it's not a trivial question. But at the end of the day, this is a decision between the patient and the doctor and their family.
John Dwyer, who's the president of the Global Alzheimer's Platform Foundation. John, we'll have you back, and I thank you so much for what you do, the work that the Global Alzheimer's Foundation does.
Thank you, Lars.
You bet. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to have you with me. I have a personal confession. I've never had to deal with long-term intractable pain of any kind. And they've had to take some pretty stiff painkillers. The problem is, the government has overshot on in both directions, both by encouraging the use of pain remediation of one kind or another, many times opioids, and now going back the other direction. And I wanted to talk about that with Red Lawhorn, who's a PhD in engineering systems. He's also on the board of the American Council on Science and Health, and he's written about this, and I think his comments are right on target. Because Dr. Lawhorn, welcome to the program, and I want to ask you about that. Is government overshooting the opposite direction, telling our doctors, cut back on those pain meds, even if the pain meds make sense for a particular patient?
Actually, I would slightly challenge your first observation. I think government was much less involved than private parties when it came to promoting the use of opioids in the first place. But right now, government policy, and particularly CDC policy, has so terrorized doctors that over half of pain patients who try to go to a community clinic to get assistance for ongoing pain care will not be accepted as new patients. So the doctor, the pendulum has swung so far that patients are being materially harmed by U.S. CDC and other government policy that restricts access to pain relief for people who otherwise have no other options.
You make a fair point about the private parties that were involved in pushing the opioids, but I guess to some extent, since they get their approval from both the CDC, the FDA, and to some extent from the DEA, and the DEA licenses the prescription of that stuff, the government could have at any time said, hey, you're shoving too much of this stuff out into patients. This is going to create a problem. And that is the government's job to do oversight on those things, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. DEA is presently so wedded to its own authority in the field that its agents in the field are basically levying asset confiscation orders against doctors before they've ever seen any kind of review procedure. So we have a necessary oversight under the terms of the Controlled Substances Act of 1970. But that oversight has been taken to such extremes that doctors are being railroaded out of practice and their patients are being discharged without coverage for any kind of continuing care. And that can be laid right at the feet of the USDEA and, to a certain extent, the USCDC.
Fair enough. I'm talking to Red Lawhorn. He's a PhD in engineering, not a medical doctor, but he writes a lot about this issue, about people facing neurological pain, and he's associated as a member of the Board of Advisors for the ACSH. Let's talk specifically about what the government is now telling doctors to do. They want doctors to cut back dramatically across the board in their prescription of pain medication for people. Is there a way of characterizing how much they're telling them to cut back?
In some places, particularly Oregon, the term morphine milligram equivalent dose is used very carelessly, and much mention is made of a threshold of treatment that is represented by 90 MMED. That threshold is completely inadequate and scientifically not supported by the literature, and yet the CDC insists that it is a threshold at which supposedly, by their claims, the efficacy of opioid analgesics drops off, or at least becomes marginalized, and the risks go up. Unfortunately, there is no medical data that proves that. So what we've got really is people voicing an opinion from a position of authority that is literally causing hundreds of suicides. And I mean that, suicides. That's well documented. Patients are being discharged without referral. Those who have a doctor who has had a problem with the DEA are frequently unable to find a practitioner in their own communities to continue their care. Pharmacies are not being able to fill prescriptions because DEA has overregulated the supply of and the production of opioids. So what we have happening here can properly be characterized as a war, not on drugs, but on people in pain. And this is coast to coast in the U.S. It's also very severely engaged or involved in Oregon politics. So I see a lot of this from people all over the U.S., but particularly from Oregon.
Dr. Lawhorn, I want to ask you, the MME, just so people understand, they just use that description so that you can compare apples to apples, that if you're talking about OxyContin, oxycodone, other kinds of opiates, even fentanyl in patches, you want to be able to describe how many units, so they've taken it down to this 90 MME level. Is that sufficient to meet some of the intractable pain that people are facing, depending on their condition?
It is not, and for some fairly scientifically complicated reasons. But bottom line is MME is not backed by any trials data. It's 35 years old. It was never really scientifically standardized, and there are four different models for it that produce different answers. Its only appropriate use is as a very rough measure of the equivalence of two opioids if a patient is being switched from one to the other. And there are many instances, and by this I mean many thousands, perhaps even millions of instances, where people, because of the way their genetics happen to work, can benefit from doses well over 2,000 MMED, not 90. And I have met people who are very well benefited by doses well over 1,000 MMED. It is not a one-size-fits-all world out there for either patients or therapies. And yet the CDC has been lobbying for the imposition, and many states have actually enacted in law the imposition of thresholds on either duration or dose. They're simply scientifically not grounded on anything at all except opinion.
And in this case, the doctor who faces this kind of challenge, if a patient says, look, I need this much, and writes a script for that, that doctor may literally have his license pulled or his ability to prescribe taken away?
Yes, either by DEA or by state medical boards or by state drug enforcement authorities. This varies. There's also attorney general actions in some cases. Right now, and this is grounded on survey data that is well supported, over half of American community clinics are refusing to accept new patients for pain management, and yet pain management is the number one reason that brings a patient to a doctor. There is really a campaign that could be characterized as terror going on against doctors in an effort to suppress opioid prescribing. And it is destroying lives all across America and in Canada because the Canadians are dealing with the same nonsense.
Because if somebody's in that kind of pain and they go to the doctor and the doctor says, I simply can't give you the medicine, they have two choices, I suppose, as you've outlined. One is the possibility of suicide. The other one is seeking out medicine from the street, going out and getting illegal narcotics.
Well, and that one's a toughie, that latter option. Because, frankly, what's going on in the streets is an enormous volume of counterfeit pills that are not really pharmaceuticals. They're basically fentanyl in yep. one form or another. And the doses are not regulated. Patients take them under circumstances where they're not being appropriately monitored. It is not driven, and it probably never has been driven, by prescriptions made by doctors to their patients.
Dr. Lahern, we're going to advise people to take a look at the pieces you've written for the American Council on Science and Health, and I very much appreciate your time. Thank you so very much.
You're quite welcome.
That's Richard, otherwise known as Red Lahern, PhD in Engineering Systems. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. I hate to keep giving you examples of why you should never trust the government. And there was a time where I trusted the government to a certain extent, kind of like Reagan, trust but verify. But these days, I don't trust the government as far as I can throw the federal government, and that's not very far. Case in point, a couple who owned some land, and the U.S. Forest Service came to them. My dad worked for them decades and decades ago, and they used to be a good organization. Now they just believe in letting the trees burn to the ground and throw a lot of smoke ash up in the air. But the Forest Service approached this couple and said, hey, could you give us permission to cross your property? And they, of course, being good Americans, said, well, yeah, if you need to cross our property to be able to, you know, go places there, yeah, that would be okay with us. But it has to be under the right conditions. Well, that's the problem. The detail is in the fine points, and Jeff McCoy knows that. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Jeff, it sounds like Will Wilkins and Jane Stanton have won a major victory. Tell my audience what this is all about.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Yes, our clients are two neighbors on a road about an hour south of Missoula, Montana, next to the Bitterroot National Forest. They bought their land in the last Jane bought it in the early 1990s. Will Wilkins bought it earlier this century, and there was an easement that the previous owners had granted to the Forest Service, like you said, for limited use for loggers, as you mentioned, and ranchers and for firefighters. But in about the past decade, the Forest Service put up a sign, said this is a road open to everybody, violating the terms of the agreement that they had, and as a result, there's been people speeding, there have been people illegally hunting, there have been people shooting at Will and Jane's houses, Will's cat got shot, and when they went to the Forest Service and said, well, you're not allowed to have these people on it, they just said, we can have anybody we want on it, and it's not our responsibility.
So simultaneously saying, we have the right to access your property, which you gave us the right, us meaning the Forest Service, you gave us the wherewithal to be able to cross your property, and now we can give it away to anybody else we want to, and we don't have to take responsibility for what those other trespassers do on the property. That seems completely out of line. So what's the big victory?
Why Will and Jane came to us at Pacific Legal Foundation, and we represented them. Their case got dismissed over some procedural rules. And that is what we took up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Basically, we asked the Supreme Court to remand the case back to the district court, allow the case to go forward and allow Will and Jane their day in court to show the evidence about what the Forest Service is doing, how they're breaking their agreement. And last week, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Will and Jane, said that the case can move forward. And it obviously, both of them are very happy, and we're happy to continue the fight with them.
Now, does that mean that when they go back to court, that procedural issue mentioned, and usually when a lawyer says procedural issue, it says to me, it's too complicated to explain. Maybe it's not. But tell me this. When they go back to court, can the court just say, well, we're throwing you out on procedure again? Or do they have to actually hear the case?
Well, they are going to actually have to hear the case. And one of the issues here was the government's claiming that our clients brought the case too late. But one thing that we haven't been able to show to the court because it was dismissed prematurely was that Forest Service officials told Will that they were going to close the road. They weren't going to allow anybody, not even what they were allowed to bring on the road. They weren't going to allow anybody on their easement, and they were just going to close and abandon it.
Which would work, right? That would solve the problem.
Changed. Yeah. 10 years later, they changed and said, nope, we're letting the public on. So, and then they said, well, you sued us too late. But there was no reason for Will to sue when they told him that the problem was going to go away.
Well, in fact, Jeff, again, I always remind my audience, I'm not a lawyer, thank God, but I'm not a lawyer. But if they had, after the Forest Service said, well, we're just going to close the road altogether, nobody will drive down it, and Wilkins and Stanton had said, okay, that's perfectly all right, we're happy if nobody comes down the road. If they had brought the case at that time in a timely fashion in the view of the courts, they would have been told there is no issue here, wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that happens when you litigate against the government. Every case is either too early or until it becomes too late to file. And they just don't want to reach the actual merits of any of the cases.
Well, because otherwise, what you'd allow the government to do is say, okay, we'll stop doing that thing. And they stop doing it for 10 minutes. You then don't file the suit. You get past the whatever the time limits are. And then the government just starts doing it again. It sounds like the government is gaming the system in a way that no federal judge would admire.
Yeah, and that is kind of what is happening, and it happens in a lot of different cases. And this is why it's a big win, not just for Will and Jane, but for property owners around the country. Because in these types of disputes, where especially in the West, as you know, there's lots of land, private land up against Forest Service land. There are disputes that don't come up often, but when they do come up, they need to be resolved. But oftentimes, the government says, well, you should have sued us 20 years ago, even though there was never a problem.
That's Jeff McCoy. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. If you're like me, you may look at the taxes that you pay to support public education and say, all right, I'm happy to support public education. But then on top of that, the teachers have apparently taken it upon themselves to say, if you've given me a captive group of students sitting in front of me, I'm free to share my personal philosophy of life, my personal politics, and even my personal sexual preferences with your children because you gave those children to me and I'm allowed to do that. And I find that absolutely outrageous. On that note, I want to introduce our friend, Professor Nicholas Giordano, who's a professor of political science at Suffolk Community College and host of the PAS Report podcast and a fellow at Campus Reform's Higher Education Fellowship. Professor Giordano, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Lars.
So should those teachers be taking that kind of liberty? Have we invited them to say, well, you have a classroom full of kids, you're getting a paycheck to educate them, you aren't doing that great a job of actually educating them to reading, writing, and arithmetic and everything else that goes with it. But go ahead and impose on them your own personal sexual, political, or other philosophy.
Yeah, right. Once we have the basics down pat, you know, maybe the other things we could talk about. But for now, let's focus on the reading, the math, the government and civics, and the writing, because the proficiency levels are at rock bottom. I mean, this is what our education system has produced. And they were low prior to COVID. Then once COVID happened, they dropped even further. So we have students that can't read, students that can't write, students that can't do basic math, yet we're supposed to inject this CRT, diversity, equity, inclusion, social justice, gender ideology to kids that can't even think critically. So what's the point of funding an education system when they're not actually educating children? And that's why school choice is something that we really have to consider, where the tax dollars follow the actual students. Maybe that would light a fire under the public schools. They'd get their act together, and it would provide for more competition, and we'd get better results. Because let's face it, we spend $1.4 trillion on our education system each year, if you take local, state, and federal government. The next closest country is Germany at $300-plus billion. And we rank 25th overall to the international community. Our university rankings, and I've written about this for Campus Reform, have dropped over the course of the last 5 years in a row. We've dropped in university rankings worldwide. So what are we doing? And if students aren't being educated, they're just being cycled through the system. These are the future business leaders. These are the future policymakers. It's a complete disaster.
And yet, Professor, for some reason, I'll go back to the political angle a bit later, but when you have teachers who, I think we could argue that based on educational credentials, teachers are better educated, maybe even indoctrinated, than they ever have been. I mean, how far would I have to go back to where you could find a time?
I agree with that.
Oh, do you?
Okay, please. I do. I think that's a big part of the problem is that, you know, teachers in the past, they understood the subject material. They knew the subject material in and out. And so they were confident in their abilities to teach without injecting their ideology. And at the college level, I had leftist professors. They loved education. They loved debate. They loved dialogue. But today, the teachers, while they may go through more schooling,
that's what I meant.
Actually, not experts in their field. They don't know the subject material, and so they use their ideology as a way to push that to make it as if they do know the subject material.
Well, all I was saying was they have better credentials than they ever did, because I imagine there was a time in America where you might have been able to teach not having a teaching credential. Today, most of the schools say, oh, a bachelor's is the bare minimum, a couple of years of student teaching under some guidance, and then we want you to get a master's degree as quickly as you can. And you think, well, hold on. They've got better technology. We've arguably got better school physical facilities. We certainly spend more money on them. And you've got better tools to use. I mean, it was film strips and things like that and overhead projectors when I was in school. Today, it's computers, the ability to look up anything anytime you want to. There are tremendous technological tools, and the teachers have better educational credentials. But as you say, they don't actually know the subject that well.
Yeah, and you're right about the credentialing part. See, what's happened is that we've created this cycle where teacher, you go into undergrad, then you go to graduate school, get your grad degree, PhD, then you go right into the classroom. So you lack any real-world experience. And anyone that's been in the real world knows theory doesn't translate into the real world. So they're at a disadvantage there. Then you factor in, I mean, if you just look at it, a bachelor's degree, you're only taking 10 courses in the subject material that you're going to be teaching.
Like
the
math.
Other courses are going to, exactly. The other courses are going to be either the prerequisites or they're going to be education courses. A lot of teachers will get an education master's, and that will teach you about pedagogy and everything, but it doesn't give you the subject material knowledge. And so you're right. Yes, they are better credentialed, but they're less prepared and no less than their predecessors.
And by the way, this has been a long time coming, Professor Giordano. I had a great professor. I did go to school, college, for about a year and a half, and his name was L. Harmon Ziegler. He's passed away since, but he liked to make the point. He said, if you look at any college in America, he says some of the students with the best scores typically are in the business school. He said the students with the worst scores in college as students are either in the phys ed department because they're athletes and they're there to play sports, or they're in the school of education. And he said, and the school of education tended, in his view, and this is almost 40 years ago, was sort of the catch basin where when you fell out of getting your degree in economics or actual hard science or something tough like business, the place you fell to was the education school. Well, couldn't make it in the business school. I'll get an education credential. And that was his attitude. And he said the numbers backed it up because he'd written a bunch of papers on it and said they're not preparing people. They're taking sort of the bottom of the barrel, just above the phys ed department and below everything else.
I also think that there's a lot of teachers that got into the profession for the wrong reason. You know, it used to be that public service, you got paid less, you got good benefits. And you did it because you loved the job. And then what happened? Well, teachers' salaries did go up, and it should have. But at the same time, a bunch of people got into the field because they saw you can make great money, get a great pension. You got weekends off, holidays off, summers off. And it's the one field. I mean, if you're in law, if you're in the financial industry, if you're a doctor, you have to take continuing education classes. When you look at education, why don't teachers have to take continuing education throughout their career? Because let's face it, as a teacher, and I admit this, I don't know everything. I'm constantly learning. I'm constantly reading more to try and understand more about American government and politics and world politics. And yet the teachers today, many of them do the bare minimum. Then you have the ones that go above and beyond. They do a phenomenal job, and yet they're lumped into the same category as all the other teachers because it's not merit-based.
Professor, thanks very much. Professor at Suffolk Community College, host of the PAS Report podcast, and a fellow at Campus Reform's Higher Education Fellowship. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You've got the Lars. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get to your calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Mark Hager joins me now, veteran, historian, teacher, award-winning filmmaker, and the author of a brand new book called Last of the 357th Infantry. Mark, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's good to be here, and hope things are going well for you all, and hope the audience is doing well. I'm just excited to be on.
Well, I'm glad to have you because I want you to tell the story of PFC Harold Frank and why is he one of the big heroes of World War II?
Well, Harold, he's a jewel. It really began. I was helping a farmer who had bought a historic piece of property on the farm, but very historic home, and was looking for some guidance because I do some preservation work. And in gratitude, he invited me to a farmer's lunch in, and I got there. Being a veteran, I got there a little bit late from my office at the university where I was teaching at the time. And the people that I recognize, they were already, you know, seated close together. And so when I can't do that, I look for a veteran naturally and to sit next to. And saw this one older man wearing his POW cap, and I said, "That's where I'm going." So I sat down, started to eat, and I asked him. He had a POW cap, and I said, "If you don't mind, sir, what unit were you with?" And he said, "I was in the 357th Infantry, and I was stationed in Germany in the army myself." And tried to go to World War II battlefields, and I just kind of stopped. And I said, sir, the only 357th was with the 90th Division. You guys got wiped out two or three different times in the Normandy campaign. And he got a little bit emotional, and he said, lost a lot of good men. And I was going, oh, my gosh, how do I not know him? This is my county. And yeah. We started talking, and I had a couple of napkins and then a few cards, and I was writing down, asking him questions, and I was, oh my, and then finding out more and more about him, and then the POW status, and being in Dresden and surviving the 1,000 plane firebombing of Dresden and escape attempt, and finally the farmer that I first was talking about, he said, because everyone was gone, it was just me and the World War II veteran just sitting by ourselves talking at the table, and I didn't care what phone messages were coming across my smartphone or anything. It didn't matter. This guy, I couldn't believe, was still with us.
And this is a man who was, he was with his battalion when they came onto the shore at Utah Beach, right?
Yeah, what he came in, the 357th, that was the one I was trying to figure out. I know their big battle, you know, it began when they met up with the 82nd Airborne, the 508 Parachute Infantry Regiment near the Lafayette Causeway on the Merdaret River. And the 90th came in behind the 4th Infantry Division. There were some of the 357 that initially landed, but their job was not to attack the beach. It was to get ready for the entire division to land, and their job was, as the 4th turned to go and capture Cherbourg, then the 90th was to come in and go straight across the peninsula and block any attempts by the Germans either to try to send reinforcements to Cherbourg, or if they were trying to escape from Cherbourg, they couldn't get out. And so so Harold gets there, and it's really about D-Day plus six that they begin their move inland, and then they and by the time they get to the Meredith River, the 82nd has been, you know, pinned down, fighting desperately for 4 days, trying to hold that key bridge, and just about lost it when the 90th Division arrives, and that's when Harold arrives. And him and his assistant gunner, Paul Esworth, from Frederick, Maryland. And so if you've read the book, that's where it begins, and the historians would say that for the 90th Division, their heaviest fighting in World War II would be between the Lefebvre Causeway and the Battle of Gourmetville and Boucadray, Hill 122, all in that, over 5,000 casualties in a very short time period.
I'm talking to Mark Hager, who's a veteran, a historian, and thank you for your service, by the way, a teacher, award-winning filmmaker. His latest book is called Last of the 357th Infantry. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, this man was a crack shot. I mean, very, very good. Yeah. And his weapon of choice was the BAR, right?
Yes. Yes, very much so. He was raised, unlike some of the things you see today, he was expected to be a man by the time he was 12 years old when you read the book. And I spent 5 chapters trying to explain that during the Great Depression, what that meant. So you're in Harold's shoes. You become Harold. Those first 5 chapters, and you're trying to see what he has to do to survive. And every piece of equipment, he had to learn how it operated as a child before actually operating it. And each weapon, when he would expect it to be hunt and all kinds of things, by the age of 8, he could take apart every one of the weapons that his dad and his favorite uncle, Uncle Ferris, when you read, you'll be introduced to him in the book, who trained him. That's where, when he was in basic training, and first sergeant pulled up the weapon and said, it's a Browning automatic rifle, but here in the Army, we call it the badass rifle. And it can fire some 700 rounds a minute. Harold's hand was already up in the air before he could even say, who wants to volunteer to carry it? And so he said, and no matter that, he was fascinated with it. He said he could take it apart, put it back together in 10 minutes, blindfolded. And he said he loved that weapon and took so much care. And of course, he failed in the 271st Infantry at that point in Camp Shelby, and then was at the top. And then eventually, I won't give all the book away, but they try to give him a another rank. I guess it would have been corporal at that time, but stayed to train others with the BAR. And he said, no, I didn't come here to teach. I came here to fight. And so him and a couple other BAR men, you notice, were pulled out of line after going on a 9-mile forced march to get ready for amphibious training. And he didn't know what was going on. And they were given a 3-day pass and told to report back at 6 a.m. on Monday morning. And next thing they knew, they were at Camp Shanks, New York, and then all the way over to England and then training. And that was when they put it together that this was going to be whatever was going to be the big landing in France somewhere.
That's right. That's Mark Hager. You got to read the whole book. Last of the 357th Infantry. Mr. Hager, thank you very much for your service and thanks for your time. Pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's easy. 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show if you can tolerate Twitter and haven't been kicked off yet like Tucker Carlson. Or you can go to my website. The vote counts the same at LarsLarson.com. And you can send an email to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So after 2 years of riots, multiple billions of dollars in damage to American cities, murder, dozens of them, and destruction over the issue of George Floyd and the issues connected to it by groups like Antifa and BLM, Have Americans finally gotten rid of their white guilt, or is this just the beginning of something different? Mike Gonzalez is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the author of the book BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Mike, it's good to have you back.
Lars, thanks a lot for having me on, man.
You got to tell
your voice.
Well, it's good to hear your voice as well, but tell me this. How much guilt do we have to, you know, get rid of? How do we expiate our guilt when it comes to things like this, according to BLM? And what should America do at this point, having been convinced to defund the cops, de-prosecute the prosecutor's offices, empty out the prisons and the jails? How much do we have to pay? What's the price?
Well, first of all, we know that there is no collective guilt. There's no collective sin. Human beings commit sins, and we have to recant our sins, and we have to expiate our sins. The society does not collectively commit a sin. Now, the issue here is that history has been bad. Americans have done bad things towards African Americans. We know all this. There was slavery, there was Jim Crow, and all of that really hung in the air, and it was manipulated, especially in the last 8 years or so of Black Lives Matter, but especially in the last 2 years, to do something that would not help the life of a single person, especially our fellow Black Americans, and that would be get rid of the police, not just the police. Get rid of the jails, get rid of the prison system, and get rid of the courts, which is what Black Lives Matter wants.
Yep.
So what that has led has been to a rise, an incredible rise in the murder rate in the last 2 years since the death of George Floyd. But ultimately, and this is the important thing here, Lars, and I'll finish this segment with this, is that what they want to do, what the founders of Black Lives Matter want to do, is demolish society. They want to dismantle the existing American society, the American way of life. And they say so, and they have manipulated the tragedy of George Floyd in order to get a lot of whites who felt guilty about the past into supporting this. And that has been a greater tragedy in itself.
I mean, because, Mike, one of the things that strikes me is that when I used to go on ride-alongs with the cops, one of the most common calls, especially at night when I was doing ride-alongs, was domestic violence situations or domestic disputes in many of the cases. I didn't see as many people arrested as I just saw the police basically acting as babysitters for adults who couldn't get along, and especially couldn't get along, you know, when they were, when they'd been drinking or using drugs. And it was kind of pathetic. Because I thought, here we've got a police system that's designed to do this. And here's the comparison. What they've done is I think, what domestic abusers, the most practiced domestic abusers out there, find a way to make their victims feel guilty. That is, the wife who gets slugged in the face, gets a black eye or a broken cheekbone, and then says, well, it was really my fault because I burned dinner. You know, and they've been led to believe that they are the cause. I'm not willing to go down that path. And yet that seems to be what BLM describes. You're all guilty for something that you shouldn't even be guilty for. And as a result, we have the right to abuse you, you know, endlessly, you know, with no end to it. With Barack Obama this week saying, you know, it's been 2 years since George Floyd and the murder of George Floyd. His killing stays with us to this day. They're going to use this convicted criminal, drug addict, a man who was in the middle of committing another crime when he was arrested, and the actions that happened after his arrest as he was being taken into custody were wrong, and a court decided that. Fine, that's done. But he's being used as some kind of hero, saying, you white people need to keep feeling guilty for everything till the end of time. Am I wrong about that?
No, Obama's tweet was worse. Because he tied the Uvalde tragedy to George Floyd, and it was a complete non sequitur. Look, nobody around today in the United States has ever owned a slave. Nobody around today has ever been a slave. These are issues that happened generations ago. America has dealt with Jim Crow. America actually should feel proud of itself for dealing with Jim Crow, for dealing with the way we dealt with the way we desegregated. We got rid of this great wrong that was segregation. You know, America was quite when Martin Luther King went to the mall and said, "We have come to claim a promissory note." He was talking about our founding documents.
Yep.
He was talking to white America and saying, "This is what you said we have a right to, and we're here to claim it." In America, did that. America said, "We're getting rid of separate but equal. We're getting rid of segregation. We're not going to have race conscious policies forever." And I think that, you know, we should celebrate. Well, that was a great step forward for all of us, right?
Yeah.
Instead, what the founders of BLM want to do is pretend that we're an oppressive society, that there's systemic racism, which means then that the logical conclusion is that you have to get rid of the system. And the system is what produced getting rid of segregation. The system is what gave us the Civil Rights Act. Look, the reason I wrote my book, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution, is because nobody in the media talks about who these founders are, Lars. And that's the main thing. These founders, they said they were trained Marxists, and they're not saying an untruth. They were trained Marxists. But they were trained by communist theoreticians, people deeply steeped into cultural Marxism, into changing over, into taking over societies, into indoctrinating people. And that's what we have seen happen for the last 2 years. And I'm very hopeful, as I wrote in that article that you're quoting, I am very hopeful that Americans have actually woken up to this, to this use of collective white guilt, and will not allow the American system to be dismantled.
Well, and Mike, that part of King's speech, it's part of the dream speech, but all the media runs the dream part of it because that's the one everybody's heard. My favorite part is the reference you made where he talked about it being a contract with Americans. He didn't say it was a contract with black Americans or brown Americans. It was a contract with all Americans. And to me, when I heard that, because I was a little kid when he said it, but when I saw the soundbite, I thought this is the one they ought to be playing, that there's a contract there. And it doesn't matter what skin color you are, doesn't matter what gender you are, doesn't matter where you go to church. The contract applies to all of us. And he wanted it enforced for black Americans in particular, but the contract applies equally to every single one of us. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show. That's Mike Gonzalez from the Heritage Foundation. As he said, his new book is called BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. And by the way, if some of you said these people are Marxists, the ones who ripped off the millions of dollars so they could buy fancy houses in largely white gated communities, yeah, that's the kind of Marxist that Americans have ended up with. We'll get to your calls next at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. If you're wondering, because it is a common sense question, why in the world would a man so old and so feeble and so demented as Joe Biden run for re-election? I thought I'd talk about that with one of my favorite Democrats, lifelong friend Josh Marquis, who joins us now. Josh usually comes on to talk about legal issues, but Josh, welcome back to the program. Does Joe Biden have any choice but to run for re-election, given that his clear successor could end up being Kamala Harris?
Well, I'll probably vote for Joe Biden again if he runs, I think a lot of people will, but in part because I think that Kamala Harris, who I knew not terribly well, but I did know her before she became a senator. She was a district attorney, and after that, she was the Attorney General of California. She is a very ambitious woman. And there's nothing wrong with ambition in politics, but she makes people very, very uncomfortable, and particularly those who get to know her, which is worse.
Is she just ambitious? Because I have no problem with ambition either. I consider myself an ambitious person. But is she capable?
I don't know. I mean, she served as the district attorney. That's the one thing she probably did well, because all the other DAs in San Francisco before her were so horrible. And then what she did is she started a pattern that she did through, has done throughout her career, of securing power, getting halfway through the next term, and then when she's running what in politics we call from a position of safety, meaning that whether she wins the next election or not, she still has a good job. She did that as district attorney. She won a paper-thin election to Attorney General of California against the Los Angeles County DA. And then from there, won a paper-thin election to the United States Senate.
Where and she then, only course, served for 4 years and didn't accomplish much of anything, correct?
No, not really. In fact, I was stunned. I, as you have often, you know, both taunted and said accurately, I'm a Democrat, and I watched the Democratic convention, and I was kind of horrified by the debates, because I thought that Harris went way out of her lane to essentially accuse, you know, Uncle Joe of being a racist. And if somebody had done that to me, I certainly wouldn't reward them by giving the number two seat on the ticket. And I'm not sure what she brought with it.
When you say you don't know if she's capable or not, let's see. She's the border czar and has only gone near the border one single time, and that wasn't even at the border. There's a crisis at the border right now. By President Obama's definition, there's a crisis times 10 at the border right now, because he said, or his Homeland Security Secretary guy, Jay Johnson, said anything north of 1,000 a day is a crisis. We're now at well over 10,000 per day, and that is a crisis times 10. And what has, can you name a single thing that Kamala Harris has done about the border?
Well, I'm assuming, and I don't give her any great credit for it, I think it's almost funny, except it's sad, that she apparently got federal military troops to go to the border at the same time that Republican Governor Greg Abbott got Texas National Guard troops to go to the border. I frankly don't see what the difference is. And I'm not entirely sure why they're using National Guard. I mean, clearly our border policy overall has failed, and it's been failing for a long time. A lot of liberals, and I don't consider myself one of them, want to believe that America is literally an open door for anyone under any circumstances. And people who say that have clearly not traveled the world, because there is no country, not Scandinavia, not Great Britain, certainly not Canada, that just says, throw the doors open and bring me your huddle, your poor, your criminals, you know, the people you don't want. I don't like the guy you support for president, Donald Trump, and I don't like a lot of the things he said, but he does have a tendency to say some things out loud that are sometimes true. And Mexico has deliberately it's what Fidel Castro did in 1981, so-called Marielitos. He basically dumped his war on.
Let me try two data points. Did Donald Trump reduce illegal crossings of the border to one of the lowest levels in American history?
I don't know if he did. I'll take your word.
I believe he did based on the numbers. Has Joe Biden taken the illegal crossings to a stratospheric level, 9 million at this point, not even 2.5 years in, 9 million people have illegally crossed in the last 2 years, and Joe and his Homeland Security guy, Mayorkas, all run around saying, there's no crisis at the border. We have the border under control. So when you have a president who brought it low and a president who's taken it high, I know you don't like Trump. The fact is, he did a good job.
Well, you know, I've said this about Democrats, and, you know, even the blind pig finds the truffle occasionally. The fact of the matter is, American border policy is incredibly complex. A simple answer, which is no one will cross or welcome everybody, both of them are going to fail miserably. And we live in an increasingly international world, and we've got the Mexican government, a leftist populist, who is deliberately pushing people from places like Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, through Mexico, and deliberately into our laps, making it our problem.
Glad to have you with me. Glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 23 and a half years, and glad to stay with you.